This is The Guardian.
Welcome to Weekend, a podcast that helps you switch off from your busy day to day and find entertainment and inspiration in the best Guardian and Observer writing from the week. You can either listen to this as one podcast or play each article as individual listens. Just scroll down the description on the podcast page for the timings of what we are featuring. Coming up, should you blame yourself for your bad habits? Author and teacher Michael Doncor on the dilemma of whether to come out to his pupils. And missed connections, four extraordinary stories of couples who found love via small ads.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
In Norway, a woman's boyfriend forgets who she is overnight. In Detroit, a man is arrested, but he was never at the crime scene. In Spain, disturbing pictures of young girls have appeared, and no one knows who's behind them. Something strange is happening. A collision between people and artificial intelligence. Discover more in The Guardian's new series, Black Box. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes Monday and Thursdays.
Now, what if everything you know about temptation is wrong? Here, Sophie McBain explores how our ability to resist temptation is increasingly shaped by forces beyond our control. Read by Laura Shavin.
In the 1960s, the Stanford psychologist Walter Mischel devised a way to measure self-control in four-year-olds. He would leave the preschoolers alone in a room with a plate of marshmallows and a challenge. They could eat one marshmallow right away or wait until the adult returned and eat two. In the decades that followed, he noticed something interesting. The four-year-olds who had waited for the two marshmallows did better at school, were less likely to take drugs or end up in jail, were happier and earned more. He came to believe that self-control, the ability to delay gratification, was the key to success. More recently, however, psychologists have challenged his findings. Michelle's original studies followed fewer than 90 children, all of whom were enrolled in the same nursery. Once you start studying bigger and more diverse groups, a different pattern emerges. It is wealthier children who are better able to resist the marshmallow. That's partly because they're more likely to trust that they really will get two marshmallows if they wait. It's also because our ability to resist temptation is shaped by our environment in complex and under-recognized ways. Basically, we're not fully in control of our self-control. If pushed, most people would accept that luck had played a big role in their life. You had no say over where you were born, whether your parents were loving or abusive, rich or poor. You didn't choose your talents or personal attributes, your musical gifts or physical attractiveness. What you may take responsibility for, however, is how you played the hand you were dealt, whether you squandered your early advantages or thrived against the odds. And yet, even your capacity for perseverance, your grit and willpower, are shaped by forces well beyond your control. A recent twin study suggested that your genes play a big role in determining your level of self-control. And that's before you consider the influence of social status, upbringing, and income, because childhood adversity, discrimination, stress, exhaustion, and hunger all affect activity in the prefrontal cortex, the part of our brain that is activated when we try to do the right, hardest thing. If that's the case, how responsible should we feel for our lapses in willpower? Environmental influence isn't just about childhood, of course. Consider weight loss. About half of adults in the UK say that they're usually trying to lose weight, and the chances are they're fighting a losing battle. But expanding waistlines in much of the world don't reflect a collective loss of discipline so much as the consequences of the modern Western diet, sedentary lifestyles, and the rise in ultra-processed foods that are designed to hijack your appetite. Companies know the secrets to making junk food hyper-palatable. They know we can't resist food that has a similar carb-to-fat ratio as breast milk, that we don't even notice we're overeating when food is so soft it barely needs chewing. It's expecting a lot of yourself to resist a multi-billion pound global industry with a vested interest in stoking your hunger. Much of the modern world has been deliberately engineered to tap into our reward systems, making temptation ubiquitous and harder to resist. If you can't seem to focus at work because you keep wasting time on social media or getting distracted by WhatsApp notifications, consider that your phone was designed to be addictive. It was built to capture your attention. There are 1,000 people on the other side of your screen whose job it is to break down the self-regulation that you have, the tech ethicist Tristan Harris observed. If you can't stick to your budget and keep buying pointless stuff, think of how many adverts you encounter daily, how often a new one will pop up on your computer screen, targeted specifically to your tastes. None of this suggests that you should give up on giving up bad habits or abandon any attempts at self-discipline. We'd be miserable, unhealthy, and ethically compromised if we resigned ourselves to having no say in how we behave. Instead, it may help to think about willpower differently. Research suggests that the people we tend to admire for their self-control actually have to exercise it less frequently. They are good at engineering their environment so that they don't need to wrestle with temptation. They know, for example, that it's easier to not buy a packet of biscuits than to stop eating after you've opened the packet, and they're good at building healthy habits and routines. They are also better at understanding their own motivations. When you find yourself apathetic at work, is it because you're unable to resist distractions? Or is it because you don't want to do your job anymore? One study linked self-control to the pursuit of goals that you value and enjoy, wanting to do it rather than having to do it. In other words, if you really want to excel at self-mastery, try to avoid ending up in the same situation as Michelle's poor preschoolers, staring down a plateful of marshmallows and wondering why you have to play this stupid game anyway.
That was The Big Idea. Should You Blame Yourself for Your Bad Habits? By Sophie McBain. Read by Laura Shavin. Next, with no role model amongst his own teachers and qualifying against the backdrop of a freshly repealed Section 28, author and teacher Michael Doncor struggled with the concept of coming out at school. Would it start a useful conversation or spark chaos? Read by Aaron Blair Mangat.
It was my first week as a fully-fledged teacher. Pinned up next to my sixth form college whiteboard, the neatly coloured timetable told me that the AS Literature group were next. They milled around outside the classroom, brimming with nervy start-of-term small talk. How vast the site was compared with the various secondary schools they'd said goodbye to a few months ago. Stuttered lists of subject choices. I opened YouTube on my monitor, increased the volume, and beckoned the students in. 20 bemused kids made their way to their seats as I clicked to the beat at my desk, before rising to my feet to offer a laid-back two-step. I got a quizzical thumbs up. One brave soul testingly called out, "Yeah, funky, sir." As they peeled out of their box-fresh hoodies, Fela Kuti's Water No Get Enemy strolled towards its chorus. Playing cool tunes as students filed in was one of my many gimmicks I used at the start of my teaching career. All of which now seem utterly laughable. But back in 2011, I was a bushy-tailed, 26-year-old, newly qualified teacher, NQT, thrilled to have my first job at an outstanding college in genteel Surrey. I was keen to be one of those maverick, anti-authoritarian English teachers. Riding high on the idealism of my PGCE course, one of our more memorable seminars was on Teacher as Clown. I wanted my democratic classroom to be an extension of the students' common room, a place for relatable but fiery intellectual debate. Informality and eccentricity were to be mainstays of my approach too. I referred to my students as my lambs. I playfully called myself their shepherd, and sheep puns were scattered throughout their worksheets. We played elaborate versions of bingo to help memorize literary terms. I only just managed to stop myself dressing up as a wizened matriarch to better deliver a lecture on Lorca's The House of Bernarda Alba. The students were remarkably tolerant and humoured my efforts. These flourishes might have been seen as a little odd, but they weren't wildly out of place. The college's spirit was fairly open, progressive. The head of classics had the classroom above mine, and she cried whenever she read Homer aloud to her classes. Teachers were referred to by their first names, dress codes for staff were relaxed, scuffed converse abounded. We English teachers were given autonomy in terms of text choices and how we explored them. Initial analyses of characters in King Lear often centered on the question, in your opinion, which of the three sisters would be most fun on a night out? With all that freedom, I was very much at home, and I soon sensed that students felt at home with me too. At break times, the ambitious ones were relaxed when talking to me about their intractable perfectionism. The perennially disorganized ones shared their frustrations about always being on the back foot. My goal was to be non-judgmental as we solved problems together and, fingers crossed, to perhaps even make the kids laugh. Teacher as compassionate clown, perhaps. But I was not so comfortable or at home that I was able to tell my students I was gay. Even when studying the picture of Dorian Gray, where discussion of my own personal thoughts about Wilde's experience of outsiderhood might actually have been pertinent, illuminating even, I kept stum. Even though I had come up to my English department colleagues, I never talked to them about this particular reticence, this fear of speaking freely with my classes. Strange, given that we were a pretty collegiate bunch, staff room chat veering between updates on the Archers, family strife and triumphs, Yeats's tangled love life, sweary but precise takedowns of Goethe's Gradgrindian vision. Strange, given that I felt so warmly towards them, these more experienced teachers, who were sharing so much with me about how to survive successive weeks with 30 hours of lessons and 20 hours of marking. From the vantage point of 2024, when the Equality Act supposedly legislates against discrimination for a person's sexual orientation and popular culture, Heartstopper, sex education, represents the classroom as a queer-friendly space, my reticence seems archaic, incongruous. I'm disappointed in my former self too. Isn't our aim as teachers not just to impart knowledge or to get young people through exams, but to model positive adult behaviours like self-belief and pride? At the time, I was deeply frustrated about this for other reasons too. Angry about the unspoken imperative often placed on queer people to repeatedly come out in each new social context, as if we owe this information to those around us, as if this self-revelation is always an easy and untroubling thing to do. While it was galling, I also understood my hesitation. Perhaps, I thought, there was something inherently pragmatic about the choice to keep sexuality private. Why did students need to know about teachers' personal lives? Where was that a requirement on any mark scheme? I had no precedent for how to have these sorts of conversations with pupils. When I had been at school in the late 90s and early 2000s, no teacher ever told us they were gay. Section 28 of the Local Government Act, which prohibited the promotion of homosexuality in schools, was only repealed in 2003, the year I did my A-levels. And I don't think my teachers should have felt compelled to reveal their sexuality. Indeed, the National Education Union suggests to its LGBTQ+ members that the decision to come out at work is yours and yours alone. Still, there are frenzied whisperings about a couple of science teachers. When I was in Year 9, the arrival of a young maths teacher who favoured unfeasibly tight trousers heralded playground speculation about his sexuality, but nothing more than that. On some level, I reckon that, for me, a version of internalized homophobia was at play. Some deeply held, in a sense absorbed from the world around me, that my gayness, in the classroom context, was inappropriate and unprofessional. A fear that, once revealed, it would undermine me and become the sole focus of students' interactions with me. I would be that gay teacher and nothing more. 5 years later, I found myself teaching in a very different setting. A South London sixth form college euphemistically described in some quarters as vibrant and in others as challenging. Nominally, it was a Roman Catholic college. A little crucifix was nailed to the wall of every classroom, often flipped and made wonky by lively jokers as they sauntered out of lessons. Many of the students had been on free school meals at their previous schools. Something like 50 different languages were spoken across the predominantly black student body. It was rated as requires improvement by Ofsted in 2017, a year after I joined the staff. I arrived with my kooky shepherd shtick, but there was no perky laminus about this lot. Initially, my buoyancy and bags of brightly coloured tricks were met with scowls at best. It didn't take me long to understand why. The majority of my lessons were for GCSE resits. A lot of the kids in these groups had attempted the English exam 3 or 4 times and not reached the threshold grade C. Most of them had studied Of Mice and Men so often that they could recite whole chunks of it with glazed eyes. And here I was, serving up the same tired old stuff that no amount of bells and whistles could redeem. Their ire for Curly's wife knew no bounds. I did not blame them. Praise is a powerful thing. I should have recognized it sooner. But it became clear that what many of these young people were lacking was acknowledgement of their achievements, in whatever form they took. So, however exhausted or bored I was with trotting out tasks about differences between there and there and there, I made a point to incorporate some tiny sense of congratulation. Perhaps the group had been quieter than they were last week. Perhaps they had been more vocal, more responsive to questions. Maybe someone had spoken sensitively about Lenny's dialogue. Whatever good I could see and that felt important, I tried to acknowledge. And even if they found it a little corny, the understanding that I was actively looking for goodness, that I wasn't just another person loudly putting them down, enabled the beginnings of rapport between me and some of the more willing students. Even so, the seemingly difficult business of my coming out to students remained. This time, the issue was complicated by race. As a black, gay man, then in my early 30s, I had had countless experiences of covert and overt homophobia from my community. At the barbers I went to in Brixton, I clenched and winced each time a fellow customer called someone a batty man. The slur passed entirely unremarked on. In fact, it was usually accompanied by gales of approving laughter. And, not far from that barber's, I had had stones thrown at me by homophobes from a car window. I don't know why they picked me out. So I was wary of talking to my largely black classes, who were merciless with each other about things as ridiculous as a misremembered Rihanna lyric, about something that seemed as sensitive and incendiary as my sexuality. Then came a moment where something shifted. After a session with my fizzy English language group had ended, one of the students walked back into the room. What had she forgotten? It was lunchtime. I had 4 million things to do. I was at my desk sorting out my next PowerPoint, dashing off emails, writing reports, gobbling the canteen specialty, a pallid ham sandwich. This ambling student, let's call her Annie, was chatting loudly on her mobile, totally against college rules. As she blithely trotted through the door and approached me, Annie mouthed a sorry, indicating with a finger that I should wait a minute. I rolled my eyes, crossed my arms. She moved the phone from her ear and met my eyes. You're gay. In it, sir. There was something disarming about the directness. I blinked, swallowed a hunk of bread, nodded. Because I'm just chatting to my friend. He's Nigerian. You're Ghanaian, innit, sir? I nodded again. He's basically about to tell his parents, and I was just saying to him he should, because it'll be completely okay, because you're completely okay, innit, sir? I nodded again, at her, at the sandwich. Annie thanked me and bounded off, utterly unfazed. I was in shock. Angry, too, that I had been caught so off guard, and that the opportunity to decide how I would raise the issue being taken from me. Surely Annie was going to tell all the other kids, and surely any frail cordiality would be replaced by chaos. Lessons were going to be impossible, unbearable now. The next day, I began my class with Annie's group, a rather technical session about toddlers' tentative first attempts at speech, feeling pretty tentative myself. But the gossiping I expected did not materialise. Annie seemed to pay much more attention than she usually did. She worked hard, and not once did she even think to scrabble in her bag for her phone. It strikes me now that this was a missed opportunity, not just to speak openly about myself, but to have a broader conversation about sexuality, and to stand against any homophobia that might come. A door had been opened. What stopped me from walking through and moving forward? Some intuition that I shouldn't go too far and that, on this occasion, I'd had a lucky escape. This anxiety followed me to my next teaching appointment. This third school, in 2017, had me leaping into a different milieu once again. It was a highly selective, fee-paying girls' school in West London. I was doing a maternity cover and had been given, among other things, a sixth form tutor group to look after. As this was an independent school, the class was tiny, only 10 students. They were fantastic, wise beyond their years, but prodigiously silly too. For me, an ideal combo. Interesting, chatty, inquisitive. They came to me every morning for at least 45 minutes at registration. Those conversations were often the highlights of my day. The girls steered me through the social peculiarities and history of this particular school, beaming as they regaled me with tales of errant head girls and questionable RE teachers. They were weirdly obsessed with ABBA and musical theatre, and introduced me to a phenomenon called RuPaul's Drag Race, which I hadn't a clue about before their hyperactive recommendations. As they sorted out their UCAS forms, I shared stories of my own university hijinks. I was open with them about the strangeness of being in this world of extreme privilege after my last job. There was a lot of interest in my writing, the nervous wait for the publication of my first novel. At parents' evenings, their mothers and fathers talked about how lucky their daughters felt to have me as a form tutor. My ego did somersaults. Despite all this, I again drew the line at talking to them about my gayness, and more specifically, the fact that I was now engaged to my partner of a decade. This was in spite of there being a few happily out teachers at the school, an institution that prized itself on its liberal ethos. Again, the intersection of race and sexuality had something to do with my keeping quiet. At the time, I was the school's only black member of teaching staff. Because of colorblindness, fear of causing offense, not wanting to be seen as focusing exclusively and detrimentally on my blackness, I'm not sure, but my racial difference was never meaningfully acknowledged by my colleagues in my early days there. To be fair, I didn't raise it either. This conspicuous silence made me feel as if my blackness was enough of an awkward aberration. I didn't want to mark myself out anymore by bringing my queerness into lessons. Besides, I was otherwise, to use Annie's assessment, completely okay. Settled and liked and doing well in a well-paid role. A permanent position was very much on the cards. What was the hardship in not telling the kids about my wider life? It didn't matter all that much. Christmas parties are always decisive, aren't they? At my first festive bash at the school, the flamboyant drama assistant and I had a shouty conversation on the dance floor about the sexiness of the gay romance in the film God's Own Country. We talked, too, about students we both taught, listing off names, comparing notes. He'd had some rehearsals with a few of the girls in my tutor group. He wondered if I had come out to them. I said no. Embarrassment pricked my cheeks as I registered his surprise. He spoke about how he had discussed his sexuality with his sixth formers, and how much he had enjoyed giving advice to the school's LGBTQ+ society. Comparatively, I felt like a bad gay. I talked about my reservations. While he listened empathetically, he also asked me to consider how much it might mean to a possibly queer student in my group to hear me, someone they looked up to and respected, speaking honestly about myself. He asked me to imagine what it would have been like for me at school if a gay teacher had opened up about themselves. It was hard to pinpoint exactly what difference that scenario would have made to me, but it would have been an important part of my path towards understanding and delighting in my gayness. The next morning, I had my last registration of the term with my tutor group. They were singing Mariah Carey's All I Want for Christmas Is You, and getting themselves in a tizzy about the Year 12 Secret Santa. Mutterings about university acceptance letters expected in early January were feverish. I asked them about their Christmas plans. They wanted to know mine. The conversation with the drama assistant was still with me, rallying and comforting. Maybe it was the festive hangover, or the last day of term devil-may-care spirit. But I told them I was spending Christmas Day itself with my partner's family. It was sure to be a noisy affair because his family was so large. He's one of seven brothers. It's absolutely mad, I told them. They registered the pronoun. It hung in the air between us. The girls looked at each other, warmly. What I remember most about that aside that morning, and the quiet seconds that followed, was how natural it all felt. Despite it being years in the making and the subject of so much agonizing, there was no sense of effortful force or adrenalized fear. No huge sense of release or relief either. Only a lightness. An absolute ordinariness to the moment. To their silent smiling. I was smiling too. Curious about what, if anything, might happen next. Pleased. Yes, that, as the drama assistant had said, I might now be able to offer solidarity to students in need. But mostly proud, now, to be shepherding myself.
That was "You're Gay, Sir, Innit?" As a teacher, I kept my sexuality a secret until I couldn't, by Michael Doncor. Read by Aaron Blair Mangert. We're going to take a short break now. We'll be right back with the second half of this episode in a moment. Don't go anywhere.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Welcome back to Weekend. Finally, what are the chances of real romance via a missed connection? And has the internet turned these interactions from the stuff of rom-coms to just a bit creepy? Amelia Tate brings you four incredible stories about finding love in the back pages. Read by Laura Shavin.
In the beginning, Darcy had a boyfriend and an aisle seat. It was the 29th of March 2000, and she was the last person to board the plane from Atlanta, Georgia, to Sacramento in California. Hot, sweaty and tired from running to catch the flight, she was frustrated to see that someone else was in her seat. "I'm sorry," the stranger said. "Do you mind switching with me?" The thing was, he explained, his wife was afraid of flying. He wanted to sit by her. Darcy McGaffick is 6 feet tall. There's a reason she'd booked to sit in the aisle of the exit row. The stranger gestured to his seat, right at the back of the plane, a middle seat. Darcy said, "Fine." She laughed, made her way back, sat down, and then another stranger opened their mouth. "I wouldn't have done that," the man next to her smiled. That man was Scott Germond. Just a stranger named Scott back then. They spoke for the entire five-hour duration of their flight. Darcy, who was in her 30s, told him about her job sorting out the instant replays for sports tournaments, and the pair told stupid jokes that made each other laugh. At one point, Scott asked Darcy if she was dating anyone. She hesitated. Technically, she was, but she had already decided to break up with her boyfriend the night before because they'd been on the phone and he hadn't stopped talking about his ex-wife. Darcy stumbled over Scott's question. She couldn't tell him the truth. "Well, I'm dating somebody, but I'm thinking about dumping him because I might like you." Scott got the hint and changed the subject. The pair enjoyed the rest of the flight together, but Darcy said goodbye abruptly when they landed. Her boyfriend was picking her up from the airport, and in those days the people you were meeting could come right up to the gate. She saw Scott again by the luggage carousel while her boyfriend was busy smoking a cigarette. They shared a look. Then they shared another look. He left and turned back to look at her one last time. For weeks afterwards, Darcy couldn't believe that she'd just let him walk away. For so many Darcys and Scots, this is where the story ends, a frisson that fizzles out into a could-have-been. But after breaking up with her boyfriend, Darcy couldn't stop talking about the plain guy. So her mum told her to place a call out in a local paper, the Sacramento News and Review. Darcy thought, those things never work. But she did it anyway, addressing an ad to Scott, who's a foreman. The person from the paper said it wouldn't be printed for another week, but a few days later, Darcy got a call.
I knew you were cheating on me, raged Darcy's ex-boyfriend.
What are you talking about? She replied.
I saw the ad in the Sacramento Bee.
Darcy hung up and called her mum. What was going on? How could her ex have seen her ad when it wasn't even out yet? Why did he mention the Bee when her ad was running in the Sacramento News and Review? Darcy's mum ran to get the other paper and frantically flicked through to the classifieds. Darce, one ad began. Scott knew her name but not how to spell it. Met you on a plane from Atlanta and I need a replay. I hope you feel the same. Perhaps the odds aren't so long. Perhaps a mathematician somewhere could say that it's not so remarkable that two people place two separate missed connection ads about each other in two separate papers after they sat next to each other on a plane. Regardless, that is exactly what happened. And Darcy and Scott might have missed each other all over again, thanks to their differing reading habits, if it hadn't been for that call from Darcy's jealous ex-boyfriend. They might never have ended up married. Their 18-year-old twins, Lottie and Paul, might never have been born. I don't know that it's fate, says Darcy, now 62 and still in Sacramento, working as a course developer. Her soft reddish-blonde curls bounce as she shakes her head and she raises her eyebrows behind her glasses. But I do know that we were very driven to find each other. It would be nice to know the very first time someone did it. Liked the look of someone, missed a chance to get their details, and so searched for them instead through printed words. Though he may not have been the first, Samuel Reeves did it in 1709. Writing in the British periodical The Tatler, Reeves sought the attention of a woman he had helped out of a boat. He desired to know where he may wait on her to disclose a matter of concern, he said, and provided an address where he could be reached. There's no telling whether the woman in question wrote back and became Mrs. Reeves, but the fantasy of it seemed contained within Samuel's words. Over the centuries, advertisements like this have appeared in countless newspapers. 150 years ago, E. Roberts posted a similar appeal in a New York City paper. Will the young lady that got out of a Fifth Avenue stage with a gentleman with a cap on at 10 yesterday at 46th Street address E. Roberts, New York Post Office, he wrote. In the year 2000, these printed pleas were officially christened Missed Connections by the classified ad site Craigslist. The website's CEO, Jim Buckmaster, has said that missed connections give people that second chance and represent persistence in the face of long odds. The odds seem only to have got longer. 2 centuries ago, the person you met eyes with at the theatre probably read the same high society journal that you did. Today, what are the chances that the girl on the train platform also uses Craigslist and will check it at exactly the right time, not before but after you've posted? What are the odds that she doesn't look for you on another similar site such as isawyou.com? Still, it's not impossible to connect after a missed connection, and the possibility, however remote, is the entire point. In early February, American actor Colman Domingo made headlines when he recounted the story of how he met his husband at a Walgreens pharmacy in 2005. I see this guy and we look at each other, he told The Graham Norton Show. I wave, but he just keeps going. A dumbfounded Domingo looked at his watch and resolved to return to the store at the same time the next week. A few days later, he was looking for a used computer on Craigslist and decided to place a missed connection ad. He started reading the recent ones. "Saw you outside of Walgreens," began the post from his now husband. It was just 2 hours old. These are the kinds of stories that make us swoon, but they sit in sharp contrast to the odd, sometimes desperate, and often creepily objectifying posts that populate Craigslist. "Asian beauty in purple docks. Fun size cutie with the blue coat. Looking for Henry, your beautiful feet." A number of posts aren't actually misconnections at all, and are more akin to lonely, or rather horny, hearts ads. Other posts are well-intentioned, almost poetic, but tragic in their futility. "Hey, Denise, it's Jeff from a long time ago." How have missed connections evolved over the years? And in the age of algorithmic dating, what is their future? At the time of writing, there are zero Craigslist missed connection posts for the whole of London, and only two recently posted anywhere near the UK capital, in Wolverhampton and Southampton. Is the medium dying? What might we lose if we let it go, like a stranger rounding an airport corner? Jason had never even seen Jeff when he started frantically searching for him. As a recent graduate at the turn of the millennium, Jason Hensley placed a personal ad in the local St. Louis paper, the Riverfront Times. "I'm just a cute, normal guy seeking same," he wrote. "Tall, bookish types a plus." He went on five or so dates with the men who called, but says, "There was literally no chemistry there." Towards the end of the ad's run, he finally got a message that excited him. There was something about his voice. It was from Jeff Oliarczyk, a pharmacology PhD student. In his excitement, Jason pushed the wrong button, erasing Jeff's message and number forever. Before he thought to place a missed connection ad, Jason searched nearby research institutions for PhD students named Jeff. He called a friend at Washington University in St. Louis and asked her to look at the grad students on staff. She came up with nothing. But Jason wasn't ready to give up. He contacted the Riverfront Times again and placed a new ad addressed to Jeff. "Please give me a call again. I'll try to work the phone better." It was 2001. Even after Craigslist went live, people still found each other via local papers. Jeff and his lab mates liked to read the missed connections page aloud to one another, laughing or awing, depending on the quality of the post. Yet at the time Jason placed his ad, Jeff's lab was on a break. A month passed. Jason's ad would soon disappear forever. And then Jeff returned to the lab and his friend Jenny picked up the paper. Jeff, she said, listen to this one. The first time Jason and Jeff ever spoke on the phone was on Jeff's birthday, the 15th of September. They chatted for hours, not even knowing what the other looked like. They have essentially been together ever since and got married in 2013. It's wonderful that this is how it worked out, but isn't it scary to think about how close it came to never happening at all? Jason, now 53 and a director for an affordable housing agency, tears up behind his glasses. "I wouldn't trade the depth of our relationship for anything," he says. Jeff, age 50, who is in medical science, adds, "There's also this overarching thing, like we were brought together for a reason. Because of all the circumstances, it's like we were meant to be together." This, he says, puts any minor arguments that might crop up in their marriage into perspective. Bickering about whether the measuring spoon should be held together by a ring, Jason's preference, or separated, Jeff's, is so insignificant compared with everything that had to happen for us two to be together. Michael and Sarah Nobbs feel much the same way. He wrote a missed connection, meaning Sarah never saw the words he wrote to her in the Rush Hour Crush column of London's Metro newspaper in 2008. They both liked the look of each other on their morning train. "He was the only one that used to smile back at me on a whole train of carriages," Sarah says. Michael recalls, "When I first saw my wife, I had an instant realisation that I'd always want to be with her." Because Michael has a stammer, he lacked the confidence to approach Sarah, and she didn't read the paper on the day it printed his message. "Train lady with dark brown hair. I'm the dark-haired stranger on the train, but I'm too shy to come over," it said. "Would you like to meet up?" Then Michael's working hours changed and he started taking a different train. he could very easily never have seen Sarah again. But 3 months later, they randomly bumped into each other in the street. They arranged to meet for a picnic. "If I hadn't gone that way, then I wouldn't be with my wife, which is a weird thing to think about," says Michael, now 44, and working in independent financial advice. The couple got married in 2011 and now live in Biggleswade, Bedfordshire. Sarah, 38, a teaching assistant, very much believes in fate. "There was a reason, obviously, why I met him at that time," she says. Sarah had an eating disorder when she met Michael and says their developing relationship near enough cured me. The couple's 9-year-old daughter Rita pops her head around the door. Does she know how her parents met? "On a train," she smiles, enjoying an ice cream. "It's crazy." As happy as their origin story is, seeing how different the world is for her daughter does sometimes worry Sarah. "It's really sad that Rita may never have the opportunity to meet somebody this way," she says. "It's all technology-based." Today, missed connections are an unusual mix of the offline and online. You still have to see or meet someone in real life to experience one, which means you get the fizz of mutual attraction that is missing from dating apps. But then, perhaps because you're shy or because you didn't catch someone's surname, the experience suddenly becomes akin to online dating after all. Katie McCaskey met Brian Wiedemann at the Ding Dong Lounge in New York. It was 2004 and she was in her 20s, waiting for her date at the bar. The man she had arranged to meet told her to chat with Ian before he arrived. That was the name of the bartender who would be able to hook her up with free beer. "Are you Ian?" Katie asked a cute guy sitting nearby. "No," he said. He was Brian. Their ensuing hour-long chat was so easy and carefree. But when Katie's date finally arrived, the conversation ended and Brian disappeared. Katie couldn't stop thinking about him in the following days, so she posted a Craigslist ad, not because she thought it would work, but because, "I have to get this idea out of my mind." Entitled Brian, brackets not Ian, Last Friday Night, and posted at 11:30 p.m. on the 20th of July 2004, Katie's post said, "Thank you for the beer and conversation. You were so sweet. Just wanted to say thanks, and hopefully we'll run into each other again." Brian replied a day later. The couple got married in 2009, and they now live in Washington, D.C. "I work for the Federation of American Scientists, with a lot of smart, rational people. And I think even people of that persuasion of rationality and cold calculation would say that there's magic," Katie says, tearing up. "There's just these moments that you can't explain them." As romantic as it all is in hindsight, when Brian first replied, Katie did briefly wonder if it was weird and creepy that he read missed connection posts for fun. She thought, maybe there's something wrong with him that I didn't notice. In 2016, data journalist Ilya Blinderman analysed 10,000 Craigslist missed connections for the online magazine Vox and found that posts written by men far outnumbered those by women. In LA, the ratio was 5-1. The most commonly used phrases by men seeking women included eye contact and long shot, but also parking lot. It's not hard to imagine that some women found these encounters less romantic than the posters did. As far back as 1872, this gender imbalance attracted mockery. If a lady allows her face to wear a pleasant expression while glancing by the merest chance at a man, she is very apt to find some such personal ad addressed to her, warned one New York City guidebook. Today, on Reddit, anonymous users complain of creepy missed connection posts. "I had one posted about me from a guy who came into my bar. It freaked me the F out. He told me he was old enough to be my father and still sends me creepy emails. He kept pushing for my phone numbers or saying he was going to be around my work." Perhaps this is why many missed connection websites, such as Subway Crush and Kismet, have died out over the years. And perhaps this is also why it's hard to get behind dating apps like Happn, which lets you find everyone you have crossed paths with. Yet, even as Craigslist succumbs to even deeper creepiness, one recent post reads, "Hi ladies, I'm on here looking to pamper your tired, sore feet." There is one man and one website still out there fighting to keep missed connections alive. At first, it was pure business. In 1997, store owner Varun Swab was having lunch with his accountant, who was reading the missed connections section of the local Seattle newspaper. It was the middle of the dot-com bubble, and a switch flicked in Swab's head. That could be a really fascinating idea for a business on the internet. He bought the domain isawyou.com and started putting together business plans. Venture capitalists were interested, and Swab secured funding. And then the bubble burst. Even though he lost all of his funding, Swab launched I Saw You in 2003 as a hobby, one he has maintained ever since. "I work on it in all my spare time," says Swab, now a 62-year-old retiree living in Port Townsend, Washington. Were I describing him in a missed connection column after we met on Zoom, I would say he was wearing a mustard zip-neck jumper and has salt-and-pepper hair and a goatee. While there are very few UK-based missed connections on Craigslist, there is a steady stream of them on Swab's website. "Bumped into a guy wearing a gorgeous cream-coloured hooded jacket in M&S Food Hall, Lordship Lane, East Dulwich, on the 10th of Feb. I met the most lovely foundation year fashion design student called Maddie on Sunday the 7th of January on a packed train between Sheffield and Leeds." Swab sought out the European market because of Craigslist's dominance in the US, and he bans users who make obsessive or inappropriate posts. There is genuine poetry on his website. "You were just another lady on another train, and yet you were unlike any other lady on any other train I've seen before or since." ISawYou.com allows people to use their GPS location to find nearby posts, arguably increasing the odds of a match. And yet it's entirely possible that no one has ever found the person they were looking for on Swab's website, which gets between 15,000 and 60,000 visitors a month. "I knew you were going to ask me that," Swab smiles when I ask how many people have connected via his site. "And the answer is, I have no idea. When people reply to a message, their details are emailed to the poster. But Swab has no way of knowing if this leads any further." Still, Swab keeps going because missed connections encourage a more human and romantic way to meet others. They're a perfect blend of the real world and the internet. He has a vision that missed connections could be used to kickstart an entirely new communication medium on the scale of text messaging. People would use GPS to locate recipients by location and see who responds. But he knows he needs to start small. So now, instead of trying to catch the whole world with a giant net, I want to catch one fly with one net at a time. Swab plans to partner with specific nightclubs, bars, coffee shops and restaurants to make them I Saw You hotspots. Posters would alert customers who had a missed connection there to the service. "There is nothing better than just good old-fashioned eye contact," he concludes. "Younger generations are so focused on their phones, they're so focused on social media, they're so focused on all this negativity that's being pumped out at them constantly, and they don't look up. You need to look up. There are people around you. Maybe someone thinks you're cute, and you would never know." Darcy, who met her husband Scott on a plane 24 years ago, concurs. Their first date was at a restaurant. Darcy remembers stepping on Scott's toe and hitting her head on the lamp hanging over their booth. 5 years later, they had their twins. In 2013, they got married at Christmas. Though Scott hadn't really proposed, he said something about how being married would save them money on their taxes. "It wasn't romantic. It's not great story stuff," Darcy says. But their first meeting is great story stuff, the kind of thing that seems impossible outside rom-coms and romance novels. While she understands that everyone needs their quiet time, especially on public transport, Darcy believes that we need to keep our eyes and our hearts open more. She doesn't think her and Scott's meeting was destiny. "To me, it's less about fate than choice. They chose to speak to each other on the plane, risking rejection or boredom or even irritation." Darcy urges others to make similar choices, to be more open to random encounters. "Even when they're not necessarily a love story," she says, "it might be a different kind of story."
That was To the Train Lady with Dark Brown Hair,
Extraordinary Stories of Four Couples Who Found Love Via Small Ads by Amelia Tate. Read by Laura Shaving. Before you go, we think you should check out our new series on artificial intelligence. It's called Black Box, and each episode follows a different story. The latest episode, which is out now, looks at how AI is going to transform our lives in ways that will be extraordinarily positive. Imagine if there was a machine that could see cancer years before a human can. Search and subscribe to Black Box wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes are released every Monday and Thursday. That's all from us. This has been Weekend, a Guardian podcast. If you're enjoying it, please make sure to like, subscribe to, and rate the podcast. Maybe even leave us a nice review. Or let us know what you want to hear more of. Just search for Weekend wherever you get your podcasts. This week's articles are read by Laura Shaven and Aaron Blair Mangat and presented by me, Savannah Ayode-Greaves. This episode was produced by Rachel Porter. The executive producer is Ellie Bury. Join us again next Saturday. Thanks for listening.
This is The Guardian.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.